pleasure to welcome you this evening. I want to first of all thank Rabbi Bolton for the invitation to come and to lecture. He had first extended it during January, and I've been doing it the last few years, and it never worked for me. I just couldn't do it in January and February, but I'm just so delighted that it worked out in March. And not only did it work out in March, but it provided both a challenge and an opportunity for me. The challenge is, as the schedule was, really there was 1 week, what to do in one session as opposed to two or three. Much easier to write a long letter than a short letter, as you know. Sorry. Friend Mark Twain said, so it is much easier to give three lectures than to give one lecture. In one, I had to figure out, what should I say? And then I looked at the calendar, and I saw also that it was after Purim and before Pesach, and so that, in a way, set the agenda. The agenda had to be something about Pesach. And now I can bring you back a little bit into the sources of the psychology that work in my own mind. And that is, that for ever so many years, I've taught about the Haggadah of Pesach. I think, as a matter of fact, the large lecture I gave here was about 5 years ago on the Haggadah of Pesach. You remember that? And I've always been delighted to teach about the history of the Haggadah, because it, in a way, is so present, not always read, but present. And those of you who know me know my attitude toward Haggadot. You have to use the classic Haggadah. I am one of those not at all interested in up-to-date Haggadot, because the whole purpose of the Seder, it seems to me, is to be brought back into another time. It's to experience as if you are coming out of Egypt, and to somehow connect with the literature, and that's a literary challenge. I've no doubt about that. It's a real challenge. It's a challenge for the modern participant, and it's a challenge for anybody who leads a Seder. How to bring people into that different language and that different methodology, which is essentially Midrashic and a product of the Talmudic period. So that's why I've enjoyed, over the years, always teaching the background of the Haggadah. And I was delighted to see that Rabbi Bolton was teaching the 10th chapter of the Tractate of Pesachim, which has many of the Shorshim, the roots, really, of the Seder as we know it. So I'm not going to tell you what I'm sure he has told those of you who are taking that class. And if you don't know, then you missed it. It's too bad. You have to come back another time when he will do it again. Because our Seder as we have it really is the Seder that comes out of the 10th chapter in the Tractate of Pesachim, plus and minus a whole lot of other things, which are also very, very interesting and very worthwhile. There are, just as an aside, good editions of the Haggadah. There have been for many, many years. When we had our first Pesach Seder here, I bought then the Glatzer Haggadah, which I assume is still around here somewhere. I don't know how much it's used. And the Glatzer was a terrific Haggadah. It was really an excellent first time. It was the most wonderful Haggadah. It was a solid, historic edition of the Haggadah. It was well printed. There were pretty illuminations in it. And Professor Glatzer of Brandeis did a superb job. We, by the way, have the corner on most of the books of the Glatzer Haggadah in America, in Or Zarua, because I needed more of them 1 year, and I searched the country for them and bought every one that I could find. So whatever was in America is in Or Zarua now. I mean, the rest of them fell apart somewhere, but we have all of the Glatzer Haggadah, or nearly all.
We have quite a
number. Yeah, so between you and us, we got them. people ask me every year, well, what if I'm going to buy a new Agadah, what should I buy? And I thought I would just mention one, which I may have mentioned before, but I don't remember the exact timing of this, whether I was still here or I was in Israel at that time. And that is the edition of the Agadah put out by Rabbi David Silber. To my mind, this is the best available Haggadah in Hebrew and English today. Rabbi Silber is a magnificent scholar, and not only brings scholarly material, but he's a profoundly religious individual. He's a profound human being. And he, therefore, in his choice of materials, and the insights that he brings, they're done with a golden hand, and that is a great talent that he has. And I know some of you are students of Rabbi Silber's, as we had him teach here for many, many, many years. He taught here every year. I will make reference to Rabbi Silber's Haggadah a little later on. So having said all that, about how I had enjoyed teaching the Haggadah, and have done that so many times, when I saw the calendar and realized I would have one chance, I decided to do something different, but not too different. And that was to teach a psalm. One of the things that has happened to me over the last several years is that I have lived in another world, truly another world. We live now half of each year in the old city of Jerusalem, amidst an environment that is just different from anything that I've ever known in my life. I mean, I've known a little bit, a person here, a person there, but I never lived in that world. And it's unique, as it would have to be unique, now that there is a Jewish state and that there is sovereignty over Jerusalem, and a Jew can live more or less without fear, more or less. And I say that very honestly. We live there, and we come back and forth to tell the story. So it's really quite something. And one of the effects that it has had on me is that I have expanded the time frame of my own thinking. I started out teaching modern Jewish philosophy. And I did that for many years. The first class I taught at the seminary was modern Jewish philosophy. And then after that, I started teaching medieval Jewish philosophy. And after that, I started teaching the philosophy of the Talmud. Where do you go from there?
You got Frau Blumchen.
Living in the in Jerusalem, but footsteps from the Temple Mount, surrounded by archaeology, revealing things every year that are so astounding to me that I look and I Naomi and I go on these little tours, and we can't believe what we're seeing. We just can't believe it. It's just amazing. This last two Hanukkahs ago, they uncovered in the City of David excavations, they uncovered what was called the Akra. The Akra was the Greek fortification that lasted 70 years beyond the victory of the Maccabees, when the Maccabees were able to recapture the Temple Mount. We walked there, and then we walked from there underneath the tunnel which the pilgrims took in order to go up to the Temple Mount. All of these things are accessible. It just has an impact on you as a Jew and as a religious person, so that I found myself more and more in the Bible. Having taken that route, starting with modern Jewish philosophy, I'm now spending more and more time in the Bible. And one of the things that I have done repeatedly is to spend time with the Psalms and the Book of Psalms. And the literature is such that most of our familiarity with the Book of Psalms comes from the prayer book, because there are so many Psalms that are either wholly in the prayer book. Any morning service begins with Psalms 145 through 150. So if you're used to daily davening, you're used to Psalms 145 to 50. Shabbat adds several more Psalms. And yet, Psalms are sprinkled here and there. And of course, one of the things you know when you read the Book of Psalms, and you don't read it once, you read it, I've tried from time to time to keep to the discipline of the monthly reading of the book. In 1 month, you read the entire book. And then the next month, on Rosh Chodesh, you start again. You just keep going over it. One of the values of doing this is that you become sensitive to language, you become sensitive to style, and you become sensitive to those things that fit and those things that don't fit. And that was beginning to happen to me. The Psalms, by and large, are a liturgy. They are a liturgy that was a liturgy used beginning in First Temple times and then used throughout all of Jewish history as the primary source of Jewish liturgy. And they have a number of different structural features. Sometimes there is an introductory phrase referring to the author of the book, or you don't really know whether this is a real author or a reputed author. So many of the Psalms, for example, are attributed to David. I don't see any reason to assume David didn't write a number of the Psalms, but you wonder when you read these things how many were sort of apocryphally attributed to him as well. Then there are others to whom Psalms are attributed, and frequently the people who are assumed to be their authors. And that's one aspect. Another aspect is that by and large the Psalms are, as I said, liturgy, they're prayers. They're asking God for something. Or they're responding to the world in terms of the godliness that is felt by the author of the psalm. And so many of the psalms are psalms of praise. Hodu l'Hashem ki tov. Give thanks to the Lord who is good. Okay? It's not a prayer for anything. It's a responsive form of praise in liturgical language, which has become very basic and essential to us. Having realized that many, many years ago when I studied Psalms as a student, one of the things that stood out when I became a repeater of the Psalms is that not all the Psalms fit that pattern. They're not all like the Psalms in the prayer book. And as a matter of fact, some of them bear no or next to no relation to the Psalms in the prayer book in terms of what they're getting at and how they're written, their purpose. They're certainly not liturgical. One of the tip-offs to me was length. One of the things I learned as a rabbi is that length is crucial to every experience. If a service is too long, people won't come back. Okay. So it's always been a tension in Oz Aru where we incorporate study. But Psalms usually are not too long. They're usually the right size. And every once in a while, they're not. So even from the perspective, not only of content, but simply the number of verses, some psalms stand out as having too many verses. And I began to suspect that some of those psalms probably were used for other purposes. And the most obvious one is the 119th Psalm. The 119th Psalm is enormous. It has 176 verses. It's enormous. Even in the daily reading of Psalms, it takes several days to read those verses. Normally we read several Psalms a day. Here, it takes several days to read one Psalm. It's called Tmanya Ape in Aramaic. There are eight faces. Every letter of the alphabet has eight verses. And if you notice, for example, there is a verse on the parochet, on the ark curtain downstairs. That is from the 119th Psalm. Right? It's a pedagogical psalm. Many of the verses have to do with the centrality of Torah and a Torah study. What's the psalm that's downstairs? What does it say? It says, Shalom Rav Le'ohavei Toratecha. Shalom Rav Le'ohavei Toratecha. 119th Psalm. Okay, one of the many verses, one of the 176. It's not even a whole verse, it's half of one of the verses. And we decided that first half was better than the second half, so I just put the first half. So that's also, that's the way the Psalms are dealt with in the liturgy. Liturgy, if you go through the morning prayers, before Baruch in particular, the early, after Baruch Shamar, many of the verses, or even half verses of the Psalms are brought. The second longest psalm is the psalm that I want to bring to your attention tonight, Psalm 78. And Psalm 78 is a very odd psalm. It has nothing at all to do with prayer. It has nothing at all to do with praise. In effect, what Psalm 78 is a sermon. It's a sermon. On the one hand, it's a sermon given by somebody. You will see the contents, and it has a very clear meaning to it and a structure to the sermon. It is in very flowery, poetic Hebrew. And therefore, I would characterize Psalm 78 as an epic poem. It's an epic poem. Now, it was not only my readings of the Psalms that sort of made some of these things jump out. But I always wondered about something else. When you study the Haggadah Pesach, and we show the sources of the Haggadah of Pesach, it's coming from some of them from the very early rabbinic period, and you go through the Haggadah, you kind of try to figure out what comes from the earliest period, what comes a little bit later, because it's a pastiche of many things that are put together. Did you ever ask yourself the question that I found I was asking myself, living in Jerusalem and conducting Siddarim there? What happened before the Haggadah Pesach? Let's just take round numbers. Haggadah Pesach, let's put it at the year zero, roughly, okay? Could be a little bit before, a little bit after, but somewhere around there, just because I want to use round numbers. Well, the Torah time of Moses, about 1300 BCE. Okay? Now, if you think about it, that's a long time. And Pesach and some of the things that we know according to the rabbinic tradition are obvious that you're supposed to do on Pesach, we say come from the Torah. Now, I am one of those with no doubt that the Torah goes way, way, way back. I'm not exactly sure how far back, and I don't really care whether the text itself was edited at a later period of time. Not interesting to me. I know I was a student, as it were, of E.A. Speiser, the first edition of the Ankel Bible, in his edition of the Book of Genesis. Speiser was a great Assyriologist at the University of Pennsylvania. At the time that I was teaching Speiser, I had an office at the seminary, which was the office of Professor Shalom Spiegel. And Spiegel was then quite ill with Parkinson's disease, and therefore he didn't use his office. So I used Spiegel's office. I was a junior faculty member. And I would come, I would sit down, and well, once a month Spiegel would come to visit. Because he had to get books. He was still working with books. So he had to pull books off the shelf, and he would take them, and some person, because some student would carry them back to his apartment in the apartments around 123rd Street. So one day Spiegel comes and he sees that I'm reading Speiser. And he says to me, he looks at me and he says, "Do you know why he wrote what he wrote when he wrote that introduction?" I never thought of that. He's a professor of Assyriology. You have to get his job. That's what he does. So Spiegel, who is then, as I said, quite ill, looks at me, great master of the Bible, Spiegel. He says, "He was dying. He was dying." I didn't know what to say. I lost my tongue. I simply lost my tongue. One of the gorgeous things about the introduction of E.A. Speiser to the Ankel Bible is that it is a religious work. This Assyriologist, now I know from what Spiegel said that he was point in his life where things meant a great deal to him, and he had a statement to make as an Assyriologist, but also as a religious person. Speiser writes about Abraham, and again, he's a modern scientific scholar, and he writes about Abraham and the way in which the Bible tells the story of Abraham, and how true to the facts of what we know in the ancient world. All of which is to say, I just give you this aside, that I've never been really interested in the editing of things which preoccupy biblical scholars. If the realia fit what we know about Mesopotamia 2000 BCE, it comes from there. You know, it's a good reflection of what was going on, and it's a response to it. It's obviously a response to it. As we learn whenever we do these comparative studies, so I take very seriously the general dating of the Torah to roughly 1300 BCE. And I wondered to myself, what happened between then and the Talmud? It's a long time to have Pesach. Just think of all those Pesachim. From the time of Moses in Egypt, a year later they're out already in the desert. The next Pesach comes. We have some indication of the following Pesachim in the Bible, in the Torah itself. We know in the book of Joshua, we have a sense. Joshua tells us about the first Passover in the land. We know about Josiah. So we have some information. But the key things that you and I know about Pesach about sitting around the table, about telling the story, the Haggadah Shel Pesach, telling the story of what happened on Pesach. Did they not do it? Did the rabbis make this up? Did this suddenly happen? And that's another reason why I found the 78th Psalm. It's entirely speculation on my part, and I'm telling you my conclusion, and I'll try to prove it as we go on. My conclusion will be that you can see in this psalm a very early example of what might have been a literary form of responding to the Exodus from Egypt. Okay? And you'll see whether you agree with me as we go on. I have handed out two things. One, a Hebrew-English version of chapter 78 of the Book of Psalms, Maskil Asaph. And two, some sources on a second sheet. So I hope you have both sheets. Second one says Psalm 78 sources. There's a page number at the bottom one, and you flip over, it becomes page two. Okay? But we'll start, of course, on page one. I'm going to go through the psalm. I will read a lot of it in English because I don't think that it's that important to dwell on all the Hebrew, but it is important to see some of the Hebrew for a variety of reasons. One of them is to get a feel for the epic language. I had a professor in college who was a great master of Greek, and when we studied the Iliad, everything we studied he first read in Greek. And I began to realize that you cannot understand an epic in translation. That was his point. His point was, you have to hear the poetry. Even the sound, if you don't know Greek, you've got to hear the Greek. I think that that's true, and I've always felt that way about Hebrew. That's why you have to hear the Torah read. You have to hear it with your ears. It's meant to be read. It's an oral literature, and it's an epic literature. It's an epic literature. This is, I would submit, an epic psalm. Maskil li'asaf ha'azina ami torati hatu oznechem le'imre fi efechava mashal pi abia chitot mini kedem. Fantastic Hebrew. Just great Hebrew. Characteristic of the Psalms are written in parallel couplets. Okay? You say the same thing twice in different words. Right? That's classic biblical parallelism. So you have, now the introduction is Maskil Asaph. We'll get to that in a moment. What's a Maskil and who is Asaph? Ha'azina ami torati. It's got wonderful rhythm. Ha'azina ami torati. Hatu osnechem le'imrei fi. Right? Turn your osnechem, your ear, to the words of my mouth. Eftecha v'mashal pi. I will open with a mashal, maybe is a parable, the way it's translated here. I will open a song, an epic. I will begin my epic. Eftecha pi. I will open my mouth with an epic. Abia chidot. I shall express riddles. That's not bad, chidot, riddles. Mini kedem. From days of old. From days of old. So you get the feeling now. You're being brought into a moment where there is an orator who is telling you an epic story. Asher shamanu v'neda'em v'avotenu sipru lanu. Which we have heard, and we have understood, and which our ancestors have told us. Extraordinary beginning. No other psalm really begins this way. No psalm begins with this flowery use of language that calls to mind a great telling of a story, and you're going to hear a great story being told. What is a maskil in the first verse? A maskil, how is it translated? A maskil. That's translated as a maskil, okay? That's about as good a translation as any I know. Maskil means learned, okay? I would translate this as a in my language, a Musser sermon. Musser sermon. You know what a Musser sermon is? Musser sermon, you never liked them, I can tell, because I gave several of them, and nobody really likes to hear Musser sermons. Musser sermon is where you tell the congregation that they're not doing a good job. Don't you realize what you are doing, that it's terrible? And the old rabbis are very good at this. The young rabbis can't do it anymore. We lack the courage to do it. If you want to see a good Musser sermon, read the sermons of Jonathan Edwards. The great Puritan preacher, Jonathan Edwards. My professor at Princeton, Professor Paul Ramsey, one of his first books that he published was a collection of the sermons of Jonathan Edwards. Edwards is a great Musser preacher, just a great Musser preacher. And we said that the Jews were pretty good at that even a generation ago. The rabbis I knew as a kid could give Musser sermons. By the time I was doing it, it was already going very much out of style, and you realized you had to go in another direction. You had to show people how it was good for them. Okay, oh, they would say, terrible what you're doing. Right, so this is a maskil is that. Maskil I think of as a Musa sermon. It's a Musa sermon. Okay, I shall... Where is my... Just a second here. Who is Asaf? This is a maskil of Asaf. My assumption would be that Asaf was somebody. He was a person. But we'll see in a moment that he may have been more than a person also. Many are perplexed by Asaf, but it's not so perplexing if you read the Bible. Because we know about Asaf. Asaf was appointed by David, and here in my source number 1, 1 Chronicles 6:24. There are 12 Psalms of Asaf, Psalm 50, and Psalms 73 to 83. These all begin with a superscription of Le'asaf, Le'asaf. In the first book of Chronicles, the 6th chapter, Chronicles is the concluding, there are 2 books of Chronicles at the very end of the Bible. They were traditionally ascribed to Ezra, the prophet, that Ezra had written them. Modern scholarship is doubtful about whether it was Ezra. It doesn't really matter all that much because they seem to be contemporaneous with that period, the period which is just around they try to recount the history of the Jews through the destruction of the first temple. And then finally, the end of the second book of Chronicles brings us, and it's the beginning of the book of Ezra, brings us to the Edict of Cyrus to allow the Jews to return to build the second temple. So that's the time frame that probably the Chronicles was written in, and it was, and the reason why it seems to me it makes a lot of sense is that I've always thought, together with, it's not my original thought, that a lot of history is written after a calamity. Because there is a need to tell people where they come from. There's a period of time when one doesn't know exactly what's going to happen. and whether the community is going to be able to reconstitute itself and work itself. And that was after the destruction of the first temple. I've often thought that that was what writers were trying to do. But what we learn as a result of that, in the book of First Chronicles, for example, there are many just, they're not even full sentences. They're begat so-and-so, and so on. It just goes all the way through history up to their period of time. When you get to the period of David, King David, and those who read Chronicles are very interested in the portrayal of David and the significance of David, David is a central figure. And much leads up to David, leads up to the temple, it leads up to the Davidic dynasty. Again here, if you've got a period when the Davidic dynasty is in demise, when sovereignty has ceased in the land of Israel, then these are important issues. And it's at this period of time that the importance of the return of the Davidic dynasty becomes important. And it's very basic in the prophets who are prophesying during that time that David will come back and the dynasty of David will return. And we say that to this, day, Mashiach ben David. Okay? The Messiah who is the son of David. It becomes a very basic piece of Jewish theology. All this goes back now to this period of time in Chronicles, that is portrayed in Chronicles, and David appoints a number of people to be in charge of song in what will become the house of the Lord. He, of course, is not building the temple, but he is preparing for it. Solomon will actually do the building of it. David is doing the preparation for it. And what David has done is that he has brought the ark into Jerusalem. The ark, which had been outside of Jerusalem, is brought into Jerusalem, comes to rest there, and these people are appointed to serve at the tabernacle. Well, they're appointed to serve as chiefs of song. These are Levites who are chiefs of song. I've known a few Chazanim in my life, and the best among them knows how to write a song. And they know it from all the angles. They know how to put the words to the music. And they choose the right words, and they choose the right music, and they compose them both. Here's a verse 24. Asaph, who stood on his right, the right of Eviasaph, the son of Korach, namely Asaph, the son of Berechiah, the son of Shemiah. Okay? In the book of 2 Chronicles, chapter 5, verse 12, describes the dedication of Solomon's temple. All the Levite singers, Asaph, Heman, Yedutun, their sons and their brothers, dressed in fine linen, holding cymbals, harps, and lyres, were standing to the east of the altar, and with them were 120 priests who blew trumpets. Extraordinary. It's just beautiful. Just imagine that. But here again, you have mention made of Asaph. Now, therefore, it has seemed to me that the superscriptions of the Psalms of Asaph, in all likelihood, either go back to the person Asaph, or there are among the scholars who say that this becomes a school of Asaph. It is the choir masters of Asaph, because there is a period of time between David and Solomon, naturally, and whether it's the same Asaph or Ben Asaph, but they're all called Asaph. But this is the period we're talking about. We're talking about a period of about 1,000 BCE. 1,000 BCE. All right, now I'm happy already. Because if I can find something from the year 1,000 BCE, and it has some relation to Pesach, now, that's what I'm looking for. That's what I'm looking for, okay? So we've at least somewhat seen the time frame of the composition of this 78th chapter of Psalms. I'm going back to the text itself, verse 3. Oh, just look at verses 1 and 2, by the way. Just, the poetry is so wonderful. Ha'azina oznechem. Ha'azina ami torati hatu oznechem. The Hebrew is terrific. Ha'azina ozen. And then it says, hatu oznechem in the second part. Turn your ear. So it's, cause your ear to listen, turn your ear. The end, the last word of the verse is fi, my mouth. And the next verse says, eftachava mashal fi. Okay, it's just this great repetition of language, different forms very often. Get to verse 3. And he wants to tell a crucial story that's important to tell. Now, even before I go any further, you know, I'm sure you're thinking, look at that, you know what that story is. You know what stories Jews are supposed to tell. It's coming to Pesach. Then we heard them, and our forefathers told us. Right? We heard the stories, and our forefathers told us. We shall not hide from their sons. To the last generation they will recite the praises of the Lord, and his might, and his wonders which he performed. Right? The thing that the poet has to do is to be able to create a literary form for conveying the wonders of God to the people of Israel. To my mind, this is really what's going on in the Haggadah. It's really a very similar task that the editors of the Haggadah have put for themselves. And here you can see this is Asaf who is trying to achieve that, and you see the importance of it. Right? Our ancestors told us these things. And it's important to recite the praises of the Lord, his might, and the wonders that he performed. Vayakam edut b'Yaakov v'torah sam b'Yisrael asher tziva et avotenu lahodi'am livnehem. Crucial, the last two words. He established testimony in Jacob, and he set down a Torah in Israel. All right, that's the way the parallelism in the Psalms works. It's repeating the same idea in different language. And he commanded our forefathers to make them known to their sons. It sounds better in the Hebrew, because the Hebrew has the key word in it, livnehem, livnehem. L'ma'an yed'u dor acharon banim yivaledu yakumu v'yisapru livnehem. In order that they will know the story. They will know the story dor acharon to the last generation. Banim yivaledu, the children who will be born. Just think about the little kids at your Seder. Okay, the children who will be born, yakumu, they too will get up. The yisapru livnehem, and they will tell their children. Okay? Now, when I read this, my friends, for the 10th or the 20th time, I said, I know this. I know what this is talking about. I know exactly what it's talking about. And I know where it comes from. Go back to source 3. source 2. Vayaki omru aleichem b'neichem ma avodah zot. Exodus 12:26-27. And it shall be when your children will say to you, what is this service? Lechem v'amartem, and you shall say, zevach pesach hu lad Hashem, this is a Passover sacrifice to the Lord. Asher pasach al batei v'nei Yisrael. Already have to recite the wonders. You don't just say, we're supposed to do this. You say, the Lord passed over the houses of Israel, b'mitzrayim, b'norpo et Mitzrayim, when he smote the Egyptians, the et batenu hitzil. That's the key thing you have to tell your children. Our houses were saved. We're still here. They were big and they were great, and you go to the Metropolitan Museum and half the museum is devoted to them. But those people are not here anymore. They're not here. The people who live there now came from the Saudi Peninsula. They were Arabs. They're not the same people. Who's here? We're here. We're here. You've got to tell your children that. You've got to make that point to the children. Okay? We're still here. Okay? Next. V'higadata levincha. And you shall tell your child b'yom ahu on that day, saying, Bavur zeh asa Hashem li b'tzeiti mi-mitzrayim. For this the Lord did when he took us out of Egypt. Right? It's live. It's very live. It's really live. He took us out of Egypt. And you know how the Haggadah emphasizes that. So here, I really think that what you've got here in Psalm 78, and the way he structured, the way Asaph structures this, is to recall what we already learned in Exodus in the Passover story about the significance of telling this story. Now, it is also true this is not the last time statements like that are made in the Torah. They are made in the book of Deuteronomy. They are made again and again. But the formal source, I think, is here. This is our original source. V'yasimu v'elokim kislam. And they should put their hope in God and not forget the deeds of God and keep his commandments, okay? As a Jewish parent. Right? A Jewish parent, you know, I know you all came to the Seder because, you know, you were expected to come. But you have to remember God. Put your hope in God. Not forget the deeds of God and keep his commandments. You have to keep being observant people, okay? And they should not know. Here's where the Mussar begins. Right, no sooner do you tell the child this is how he should be than you go into the following. And they should not be as their forefathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation who did not prepare the heart and whose spirit was not faithful to God. Okay? Your forefathers, they were terrible. No sooner did they see these wonders in the land of Egypt. Oh, terrible. And then here, that's interesting, the next verse, 9. The sons of Ephraim, armed archers, retreated on the day of battle. Now, all kinds of commentaries are on that verse. Let me just tell you a few of them. The traditional commentary is, which you find in Rashi, is that the Bnei Ephraim, the sons of Ephraim, left Egypt prematurely. They were so anxious to get out of Egypt that they left prematurely. And we have this in the rabbinic literature. This is an Agadah about the Bnei Ephraim. So one possibility is that this is referring to the Exodus and the Ephraimites who couldn't wait to get out, and they were eventually defeated in battle. Because, as you know, one of the themes of the Torah is that the people have to stay together. They have to stay together, they have to be together, they have to fight their enemies together. That's why even once the land on the far side of the Jordan was captured, all of the tribes, the armed men, had to go into the land of Israel to not leave it to the other tribes alone. Here, according to the Agadah, so could be that what we see reflected here in a psalm from the year 1000 BCE is the earliest layer of these Agadot. Okay, that the Agadah goes way back. It goes back to this period in time. Okay, and you can see it was already established here. Could be something else. Could be that the Bnei Ephraim is referring to the generation of the Shoftim, of the judges. During the period of the judges, the tribe of Ephraim was ascendant, both in size and in power, and the Ephraimites were very anxious to be able to be the key players going forward. In fact, they are not. They are not, and you will see that this is discussed later on in the psalm. So partly because of what is said later in the psalm, it may be that what we were referring to here is the period of the judges, and Ephraim, which is to say, that's a klal, a general word for the Israelites, since they were the most prominent of the tribes at that point, that this is really referring to the Israelites in general during the period of the judges. Okay? It could be that this is referring to, again, what's referred to later on in the psalm as Shiloh and the destruction of Shiloh, which occurred during that time. We know that the Benjamites, the tribe of Binyamin, they were located next to Ephraim, and many of them lived with the Ephraimites. And among the Benjamites, who are very crucial players, are Saul. Saul is Benjamini. Benjamini. He's a Benjamite. Okay? So this could be reflecting on recent pre-Davidic history, which is not complementary to a great number of the leadership, a great piece of the leadership that in fact will come into demise with finally the victory of David, who is from the tribe of Judah. So it may be that what we are starting off with here is the poet reflecting back on most recent history, not all the way back to the Exodus from Egypt, but having given us a little bit of an introduction which does tell us about Egypt, to go from there to the recent history, which is a very common thing in preaching, by the way. You bring people back, you start a subject and you want to bring people to where their own experience is, the politics of the moment, as it were. And this can very well be the politics of the moment. This may be reveal what the politics of the moment was. They forgot his deeds and his wonders which he showed them. Before their forefathers he wrought wonders in the land of Egypt, in the field of Zoan. Zoan is a biblical term that is frequently used for Egypt. It was the capital of Egypt at a certain time. It was one of the main Egyptian cities, and it was on the eastern Nile Delta. And in the book of Numbers, 13:22, it says it was built 7 years after Hebron. It was built 7 years after Hebron. Hebron is a very, very ancient city. Okay? Jewish Hebron is... Abraham comes to Hebron 2000 BCE, but it was a well-established city already, Hebron. So Tzolan is timed in the book of Numbers to go back to that period. Scholars say perhaps it is the old Hyksos capital of that part of Egypt, which was called Avaris. He split the sea and took them across. He made the water stand as a heap. Okay, now you know all this language. This is the language of Kriyat Yamsuf, of the splitting of the Red Sea. He led them with a cloud by the day and all night with a light of fire. He split rocks in the desert and gave them to drink as from great deeps. He drew flowing water from a rock and brought down water like rivers. So with all of that, what did they do? But they continued to further to sin against him. Okay? To provoke the Most High in the desert. They tried God in their heart by requesting food for their craving. You remember? Right? They were not happy with the man that they received, and instead they wanted meat. They spoke against God, and they said, can God set a table in the desert? Now, I want to just sit on that for a moment. Look at the Hebrew. Vayedaber belokim amru hayuchal el la'aroch shulchan bamidbar. A great phrase. La'aroch shulchan bamidbar. Shulchan aruch. What does that remind you in the Passover Haggadah? What is it called? What's it called in Hebrew? Shulchan Orech. Shulchan Orech is the meal in the Seder. It seems to me that one of the things that I learned from this is that the meal at the Seder is not only the meal at the Seder. It is the gift of God. It is God's gave our people in the desert a Shulchan Aruch. The table was set. Right? Shulchan Orech is really part of that experience of the desert. And I would underline that. I think that, you know, we don't see the proper context of a meal. The meal really was God's gift, all as part of this process of the exodus from Egypt, and food was very basic to that. The matzah, we know. The matzah, of course, the food, the double matzah, the all of that. But the meal itself, it seems to me, plays a crucial role here, and that's what I learned from verse 19. True, he struck a rock and water flowed and streams flooded. But what did they say? Can he have meat too? They doubted God could bring meat. Can he prepare flesh for his people? Therefore God heard and was incensed. Fire was kindled against Jacob, and also wrath ascended upon Israel, because they did not believe in God and did not trust in his salvation. And he had commanded the skies from above, and he had opened the portals of heaven. He had rained upon the manna to eat, and he had given them the corn of heaven. Men ate the bread of the mighty. He sent them provisions for satisfaction. He caused the east wind to set forth in heaven, and he led the south wind with his might. He rained down flesh upon them like dust, like the sands of the sea, winged fowl. All right, that's the quail that finally they receive.
I think Jewish guilt goes back at least 1,000 years, right?
This is not 3,000 years. 1,000 years BC. This is classic guilt stuff. It's incredible. It's just incredible. It's incredible. And he let it fall in the midst of the camp around their dwellings. Look at what I did for you. Look at what I did for you. You didn't even have to go out of your house. It was sitting there. Fresh direct. They ate and were very satisfied. And he brought them their desire. They were not estranged from their desire while their food was still in their mouth. The wrath of God ascended upon them and slew some of their stoutest and caused the chosen of Israel to fall. Despite all this, they sinned again and did not believe despite his wonders. Right here, the whole point is to teach your children the wonders of God, and they take everything for granted. Did you ever know children to be like that? I never knew children like that, okay? They get everything. They don't even have to ask. They just get it. And they're ungrateful, ingrates. And he ended their days in vanity and their years in terror, and he slew them. They would seek him, and they would repent and pray to God. All right, every once in a while they turn back. All right, they got smart. And they remembered that God is their rock and the Most High is their Redeemer. What happens then? They beguiled him with their mouth, and with their tongue they lied to him. Their heart was not sincere with him. They were not faithful in his covenant. But he is merciful. All right? He expiates iniquity and does not destroy. Many times he takes back his wrath and does not arouse all his anger. I want to look at the Hebrew of this verse, because the Hebrew is a crucial verse for those of you who know the prayer book. Yeah. This verse in the prayer book is one of the most repeated verses. You know it by heart. Right? This is what you say before the beginning of the Maariv prayer. And then you say Baruch Hu. Right? This is a basic piece of Jewish prayer. This, it's said in the morning service, said in the evening service. What I want you to see here, this is a familiar verse, one of the few very familiar verses in this psalm. Repeated all the time, but you have to see it here for the context. think of everything that we just said above. This is the lack of gratitude of the people and the knowledge that we are sinners. Right? That we are sinners, not only that, our ancestors were sinners. Not only we're bad, they were bad. I once went to, I was a guest at the Lutheran church at Citicorp, and I was preaching, I had to speak there. And I'd never been to a Lutheran service before. So, first of all, I went with the priest, took me into the robing room. They have a robing room there. And in the robing room, they dress up like the Kohen Gadol. I mean, it's really something that's just beautiful, really gorgeous. It's just like in the Torah. And then they come out, and we had a long line, a big processional. I walk in the processional. And then they start the service. This was an evening service. I think it was an evening. The truth is, I don't remember. So I must have done it twice, once in the evening, once in the morning. And I don't remember which one this is. So I start the service. The service starts, we are sinners, and our ancestors were sinners. And you know, I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. So this is a very basic biblical perspective on those who are sitting down to pray, which is to remember the sinful nature of the human being. And that is the background then. Everything that came before Vahurachum, and when you say it again now, you know, in future times, just remember the background. This, I think it gives it more power and context. And he remembers, it goes on 39, he remembers that they are flesh, a spirit that goes away and does not return. All right, that's the fragility of the human existence. God remembers that. You know, he comes back to us and he's merciful, and he remembers how weak we are, how often they provoked him in the desert, vexed him in the wasteland. They returned and cried. God. Again, we're back to the same theme. And sought a sign from the Holy One of Israel. They did not remember his hand the day that he redeemed them from distress, who places his... Now, suddenly, going to go back to Egypt. Going back to Egypt. So we started with implied reference to Egypt. Now we're going to go back to Egypt in detail. He turned their canals, who placed his signs in Egypt and his wonders in the field of Zoan. Okay? We're now going to have a repetition of the wonders of Egypt, some of the wonders of Egypt. He turned their canals into blood and their flowing waters they could not drink. Okay? Recitation of the plagues. He incited against them a mixture of wild beasts which devoured them. Okay? Arov. Arov. The Hebrew says it. Yishalach bahem Arov. That's the plague of Arov. The Yochlem. And the plague consumed them. The beasts ate them. Utzfardeh v'tashchitem. Right? Came the frogs and destroyed them. He gave their produce to the finishing locusts. Beitin lichatzil. Chatzil is a Hebrew word. It's a synonym for arbeh. V'yigiyam la'arbeh. Okay, that's again the biblical parallelism where you have the same thing twice in a verse. Yigiyam, their toil, namely they toiled in their fields, and the locusts ate the product of their labor. Yarog babarab gafnam. Right? He caused their vines to die from the barad, from the hail, the shikmotam, and their sycamores, bachanamal. Now, chanamal, Rashi says, means locusts, and that's the translation here. I don't think it means that. I don't think it can mean that. Because, again, it's biblical parallelism. The second half of the verse most likely means the same thing that the first half of the verse means. And the scholars have said that chanamal, all the research is that it is probably, it means kafor. Kafor. Frozen particles. But what we have outside here... in abundance, okay? That's kafor, or kafor. And so what this is probably saying, and we know that in the Bible, you have Geffen, your vine, and your what's next? Your fig tree, right. And it's been pointed out that a shikma, a sycamore, looks like a fig tree. It's a sister of a fig tree. So this probably is a synonym for your vine and your fig tree. Okay, it's just another way of saying your vine and your fig tree. And two words for hail, one the common barad, and the second one, chanamal. Okay? Vayasker, and he gave over their animals to the hail and their cattle to the fiery bolts. That could be, it would make the verse parallel, that rishafim are burakim, that they're fiery bolts. But it could be also there are those who have argued in the book of Habakkuk, the word rishafim there is a synonym for dever, pestilence. And we know the plague of pestilence, and so this may be a reference to the plague of pestilence. Okay? He dispatched against them the kindling of his anger, wrath, fury, and trouble, a delegation of evil messengers. Now, in English, you won't recognize it. But I want to read this in Hebrew. Memtet. Yishalach bam charon apo evra vaza'am v'tzara mishlachat malachei ra'im. Where have you heard that before? It's the Haggadah of Pesach. That's the Haggadah. This is, the Haggadah is quoting this verse. And keep in mind then that the context of the quote is the 70th Psalm where we have just mentioned the plagues. Alright? Now we'll come back to this in a moment. He leveled the path for his anger. He did not withhold their soul from death, and he delivered their body to pestilence. So I think that this is the defer. This is the plague of defer, assuming that the previous one didn't mean defer. And then he smote every firstborn in Egypt, the first fruit of their strength in the tents of Ham. Ham is a biblical word for Egypt because they are the descendants of Ham in the Bible and the story of Noah. So that is the conclusion of the mention now of the plagues. Now, let me just go back. First one was Dam. Okay? That was verse 44. The second one is Arov, wild beasts. Now, you know that that's not the second plague. So, immediately it's clear that this is not in the same order. The second plague is Sardea. Okay? Sardea was the second plague, frogs. So the frogs and the arov are out of order here. Okay? So number two is the wild beast. Number three is frogs. Number four is locusts. Number five is hail. Number six is dever. And number seven is the firstborn. Seven is the firstborn, okay? So number one, they're not in the same order. Why? I don't know the answer. And I've not read any good answer, except that it's poetry. And that in poetry, poets do things like this. Could be that they're grouped together in a certain way. Or could be that it just came out that way, that the meter and the language was such that, again, here I go back to my contention that this is an epic poem. It's an epic poem. And things happen in the poetry which are not necessarily exactly the same as in the original. Okay? The poet will substitute other words just because it doesn't seem to fit the preacher correctly.
Or it keeps you awake.
Or, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. All right, that could be an issue. This is so long that it could be boring. And, you know, if you're listening, you say, something's wrong here. Something is wrong. Very nice. Very good. Okay? That's terrific.
Sequence, where are we in time? Wasn't this the original and the Haggadah was later?
Haggadah is 1,000 years later.
Right, so maybe this is the original and the Haggadah.
That's also, many of the scholars have said that maybe what we have here is at least an alternate series of plagues. And that this maybe is more original, because we've got them in the Torah. But then that would be a proof that the scholar could say that piece of the Torah must be much older. It must be older, and that perhaps this goes back further. This is the original, and what we have in the Torah is actually older. I can't answer any of these questions. There's no way to know the answer to them. No way to know the answer. Again, my predisposition is to take the Torah for what we take it for, namely that it predates all of this. And to go, I think Terry's suggestion is the best one that I have heard, that it's interesting to hear something like this, where it is left out. And of course, there are three missing. There are three missing. I wanted to share with you a portion of Rabbi Silber's Haggadah, where this Haggadah, if you open it from the left side, are his introductions. If you open it from the right side, it's his Haggadah. So I think, as a matter of fact, Lasse does the same thing, if I remember correctly. Maybe I'm wrong. But this doesn't. So here he says the following. As Nachum Sarna and other scholars have pointed out, there is a striking literary character to the Ten Plagues passages in the Torah, which exhibit a structure based on threes. This is Nachum Sarna. The first two plagues, blood and frogs, are each accompanied by a warning, whereas the third plague, lice, comes about with no prior notification. This pattern repeats itself for the next two sets of three. The fourth plague, swarming creatures, Arov, and the fifth plague, pestilence, are forewarned, while the sixth, boils, Shrin, is not. And that's how they're presented in the Torah. Moses comes, warns the Pharaoh that this is going to happen, and you get that. Moses comes again, you get a second plague, comes the next one, Moses doesn't go and warn the Pharaoh. That happens repeatedly. Okay? Likewise, Pharaoh is alerted before the seventh and the eighth plagues, hail and locusts, but not before the ninth, darkness. Similarly, the time at which the warning took place is specified as morning for the first plague in each set of three, that is, the first, the fourth, and the seventh plagues, whereas the time of the warning for the second, fifth, and eighth plagues is not given at all. Furthermore, the first two plagues in each set of three are focused on specific locales. The first and the second plagues revolve around the water, specifically the Nile River. The fourth and the fifth plagues relate to the land. And the seventh and the eighth plagues come from the sky. This grouping, he goes on, what I read you so far is a quote from Sarna. Now, this is Silber. This grouping seems to be echoed in Psalm 78, which, along with Psalm 105, which I've also brought in the sources, in case you want to look at it, provides an alternative listing of the plagues. Sarna claims that in contrast to the book of Exodus, which lists 10 plagues, each of the Psalms lists only 7. Here he has in parentheses, in truth, counting the plagues in these psalms is not simple, given their impressionistic rendering. He's quite right. In Psalm 78, the order of the plagues seems to be blood, swarming creatures, frogs, locusts, hail, pestilence, and firstborn. Assuming the list is accurate, missing from Psalm 78 are plagues 3, 6, and 9, namely lice, boils, and darkness. The same three plagues that, as noted, arrived without forewarning. Okay? That's how he sees the plagues in the psalm, and many of the commentators observed exactly that. Read in this way, it seems that Psalm 78 records a tradition that counts seven plagues as a derivative of the Torah's 10-plague tradition, excising from the record those plagues that were experienced as continuations of the previous ones. And I could see a nice modern comment on that, which would be, that God wants to always warn you before something is going to happen. Now, and these were, Pharaoh was not warned, we're not as comfortable with that. Okay, and they therefore didn't make it into the 78th Psalm.
Such modernists.
Correct. 3,000 years ago, they were incredibly modern. They had the same problems. Okay. All right. Now, that's point number one. Point number two is this verse. Yishalach bam charon apo evra vazam v'tzara mishlachat malachei ra'in. Okay, now you remember where that comes from. I have that in the source here. This is where I, and number five, I brought the whole section of the Haggadah, which begins Tavarcha b'yad chazaka shtayim, v'bizroa netuya shtayim, v'omara gadol shtayim, v'motot shtayim, v'motim shtayim. Now, one of the interesting things, in light of reading 78, is that the numbers seem to be an issue here. Okay? You take a verse, there are five words in the verse, each one is attributed to two, two times five is ten, you've got 10 plagues. I wondered to myself, could that have been an issue? Could that have been an issue that they were worried, or they knew that the Psalm says there were 7 plagues? The Torah says there were 10 plagues. And so one of, perhaps behind what we have in the Haggadah is an effort to make it very clear that what the Torah says is what happened. Okay?
Yeah, but they ended up saying there are 250 plagues.
Oh, you've got to get to that. That's the result of our verse is going to take us.
The disparity gave them license to come up with correct. Whatever number they want.
That's a very good point. Maybe the disparity gives you license. And so once you have license, you can be creative. And they begin to be creative. They start out with simply finding 10, and that's only the beginning of the numerology that happens here. The numbers go way beyond that. Okay, so here, let's go, turn over in the back. You have the list of the 10 plagues. Rabbi Yehuda was accustomed to giving mnemonics, Tetzach, Adash, Be'achav. Okay, that's what we know, that's the mnemonic. Now, then begins the Baraita of Rabbi Yossi Haglili. And that's this incredible Baraita where he says, Rabbi Yossi Aglili says, Minayin ata omer shalako amitzrim bin mitzrayim eser makor. How do we know that in Egypt the Egyptians were smitten with 10 plagues, v'alayam laku chamishim makot, and on the sea it was 50 plagues? Now this is a midrashic way of saying that the miracle at the sea was even greater than the miracles in Egypt. Okay, that's the way the Midrash makes a point. Mahu b'Mitzrayim, Mahu Omer. What does it say about Egypt? Yomru Achartumim. The magicians said to Pharaoh, "This is the finger of God." And on the sea, what do you say? Yad. Okay, Yad is a whole hand, five fingers. All right. So now we're into this, and that's just the beginning. Rabbi Eliezer says, Minayin shakol makal makal shehidi HaKadosh Baruch Hu lamitzrim b'mitzrayim ha'yata shal arba makal. How do we know that every one of the plagues that was in Egypt was really 4 plagues? 4 plagues? Shenemar, as it says, and where does it say it? It says it right here, in verse 49 of Psalm 78, Yishalach Bam Charon Apo. Yishalach Bam Charon, Yishalach, there shall be let go on them. Charon Apo, Evra Vaza'am Vitzara, Mishlachat Malachei Ra'im. Evra Achat. Right? The first of the words there, he begins counting with the word Evra. One. Vizam Shtayim. Vitzara Shalosh. Mishlachat Malachei Ra'im Arba. Omer Me'ata. Now, of course, he knows the verse, because the verse in Psalms that deals with this is this verse 48. Okay? Verse 48. And he does, 49. And he does a drash on the verse, which is not unusual. That's classic rabbinics, in order to show that in that verse, you can prove that each plague was really four plagues. And then the next one, of course, is Rabbi Akiva Omer, Minayin Shakol, Makam, Makash, Ebi Akadosh Baruch Hu, Mitzrayim, Ata, Shal Chamesh, Makam. Every one of those in Egypt is really of five plagues. Shneamar Yishalach, Yishalach. Okay, and he just breaks the verse up slightly differently. Evra, Vazam, Vitzara, Mishlachat Melech Erahim, Charon Apo, Achat, Evra, Shtayim, Zam, Shalosh, Zara, Arba, Mishlachat Melech Erahim, Chamesh. Emora Meata, the Mitzrayim Laku Hamishim Makot Va'alayam Laku Hamishim Matzayim Makot. Okay? In Egypt, they were plagued with 50 plagues, and on the sea, since it's five times, we already learned that up above from Yossi Aglili, you multiply by five and it becomes 250. Now, just a word of explanation about this. The argument of four and five, I believe, goes back to a classic argument in Greek philosophy, which is an argument about the basic number of substances. You know that in Greek philosophy there's the idea of four basic substances out of which everything is created. And there was a dissenting opinion which included not only fire, air, earth, and water, but the fifth, which was hyle, which is unformed substance. So to my mind, what you see working itself out here is a classic argument from Greek philosophy, but as used by the rabbis, either playfully or philosophically, or to keep interest alive. I leave that for you to decide. Maybe, as you said, Mark, once you've opened the door, really, for these things, there's a certain fun in it. There's really fun in it. And that's also part of the Haggadah. I'm going to go quickly, and I want to get now to the end. He leveled the path for his anger. He did not withhold their soul from death. We're on 52, I'm sorry. Then he caused his people to journey like sheep, and he led them as a flock in the desert. He led them securely, and they were not afraid, and the sea covered their enemies. He brought them to the border of his sanctuary, this mountain that his right hand had acquired. So that could mean the whole land of Israel. That could mean the Temple Mount. My hunch is that it means the Temple Mount, because of what will follow now. He drove out nations from before them. Oh, by the way, the end of Shirat Hayam, the Song of the Sea, which we recite every day in the morning service, the very end of that is, you have the story about coming through the Red Sea, and then it says, the very end is, and he established their sanctuary, the very end of Shirat Hayam. Right? It's just, and this seems to me is the same thing. It's the same thing. You're finishing a discussion. You're going through the plagues. You get to the Kriyat Yam Suf, the splitting of the sea, and then you mention the temple. and the creation of the temple. He drove out nations before them. This is now subsequent, and well, subsequent to the splitting of the sea, and allotted them an inheritance by land, and he caused the tribes of Israel to dwell in their tents. Yet they tried and provoked the Most High God and did not keep his testimonies. They turned back and dealt treacherously as their forefathers. They turned around like a deceitful bow. They provoked him with their high places, and with their graven images they angered him. God heard and became incensed, and he utterly rejected Israel. And he abandoned the tabernacle of Shiloh, the tent that he had stationed among men. He delivered his might into captivity and his glory into the hand of the adversary. This is the battle against the Philistines. The Philistines destroyed Shiloh. Here, the Philistines were being fought against by Saul, by and large, until David comes into the picture. Fire consumed his youths, and his virgins were not married. All this was the wars against the Philistines. His priests fell by the sword, but his widows did not weep. And the Lord awoke as one asleep. All right? So in other words, the Jews suffered under the heavy hand of the Philistines. And then one day God woke up. That's the language. God woke up as a mighty man shouting from wine. God wakes up and he's back with his people. And he smote his adversaries from the rear. He gave them perpetual disgrace. That is the destruction of most likely of the Philistines by David now. David becomes the powerful figure. He rejected the tent of Joseph and did not choose the tribe of Ephraim. Leadership passed not to the powerful who were of Ephraim, but to the tribe of David, but to David of the tribe of Judah. He chose the tribe of Judah. And what does David then conquer? Mount Zion, which he loved. And he built his sanctuary. Right, the whole psalm now is coming to a conclusion with the construction of the temple. With the construction of the temple, like the high heavens, like the earth, he established it forever. And he chose his servant David and took him from the sheepcotes, right, he was a shepherd. From behind the nursing ewes, he brought him to shepherd Jacob, his people, and Israel, his heritage. And he shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart, and with the skill of his hands, he led them. And thus ends the psalm. It ends with the triumph of David, with the temple and of David. Now, a few things in conclusion. Remember who appointed Asaph? David. David appointed Asaph. David is looking forward to the building of the temple. Keep in mind the Passover Haggadah. After the passages that we've just looked at, remember what comes next? What comes next is something that we enjoy because it's Dayena. Right? Ilu, ilu, hotzianu, hotzianu, mimitz. And what is Dayena? It is a story that goes through Jewish history. Just the way this psalm is. That's what Dayenu is. Dayenu is a psalm that recounts again all of the history. And remember how Dayenu ends? Shebalda lanu bet hamidash, who built for us the temple, just as this is the end now of the psalm. Scholars have argued about the antiquity of Dayenu, many of whom say they point to the fact that the first time it appears in the Haggadah, it appears in the Haggadah of, it doesn't appear already in Rav Sadia's Haggadah, or what we know of that, it appears rather late on, so it must be a medieval piece. I would like to argue on the basis of this that probably Dayenu is one of the oldest parts of the Haggadah. It is clearly patterned on this psalm. And clearly the building of the temple is seen as the high point of this entire process of the Exodus from Egypt. You have other things that are not unimportant, like the giving of the Torah and of the Sabbath and all those things that are accounted in Dayenu. When it comes to the end of Dayenu, the point is that it is the temple that is there. And what is the reason for the temple? It says in Dayenu. The chapera, or call avanotenu, in order to atone for all of our sins. Exactly the mental framework of the 78th Psalm. We are sinners, we are not grateful to God, and what we need to do is to remember all the reasons that we should be grateful to God for all of his gifts to us. I would like to submit to you that I see that in the 78th Psalm. Maybe my speculation has something to offer, but this is a very, very early form of the ideas that we come to know 1,000 years later in a very different literary form in the Haggadah of Pesach.
Koach. Wonderful. Thank you, Rabbi Wexler.
Here explains why we have so many Jewish psychiatrists.
No doubt about it. You know we've concluded that, then. You and I.